Thank you very much. It's always great to be in Santa Barbara. I always enjoy my visits to KITP. So today, I'm going to give kind of a wide-ranging talk. I hope I don't jump around too much. I'm assuming, I know this audience is pretty sophisticated slash jaded, so I'm assuming that if I jump around, people won't take offense. So we've put a lot of effort into ruthenium trichloride in the last couple of years. And so on a personal level, I've kind of, in my own thinking, I'm looking to the next problem. And so I'm just going to talk about some of the ideas that I've been entertaining. And so here are kind of the long-term collaborators on ruthenium trichloride, and presumably most of them will also work on the new materials that we'll eventually come up with, hopefully. But this project originally started with just a collaboration between me and Steve Nagler, and it's kind of grown a lot over the years. Okay, so Joel mentioned this. He flashed this up in his talk, but I wanted to expand on this a little bit. So everything not forbidden is compulsory. This was sort of a working principle that Murray Gell-Mann operated under. And we're kind of in the same boat as people who make materials, because there's all these predictions of all these new states of matter that are coming at us now, kind of like drinking from a fire hose. And, you know, we're about to spend maybe a couple of years of our lives, you know, trying to realize some of these new states of matter. And so really it takes kind of a leap of faith, right? And so this is kind of the working principle we have. You know, if I'm going to spend 2 years of my life trying to create something, I have to have some kind of faith that it's actually going to be there, as long as the theorists have done their jobs properly. So, and haven't violated any laws of physics yet. So that's the kind of gamble we're taking, those of us who try to find new materials. All right, so this is one of the reasons I like Gataiev materials. It's such a beautiful story. It starts off several years ago with a toy model. It's a toy model that can be solved exactly, and Gataiev, I don't think, gave any thought at all to whether actual materials could behave in the way his model solved. And I know at some point he was getting funding from Microsoft, and I know at some point, you know, in his paper, he talks about one of the motivations for his work. And later on, I'll talk about why this may not be as crazy as we thought it was a couple of years ago, that it might actually be useful for something someday. And so, of course, the Gataiev model, it's the key thing is this bond-directional Ising coupling. And it takes place on a honeycomb lattice. And the Ising interactions, basically, I'll show you in another figure, it's a little more clear. But you have, so here the Z components are coupled, Y components, X components. And so there's frustration built right into the model. And the ground state is an exactly solvable quantum spin liquid. And the excitations are gauge fluxes and Majorana-Fermion pairs. And so this slide is from Yuji Masuda. He gave it to me about a year ago. I hope he doesn't mind if I use it. But it's a nice slide. It kind of shows what the Majoranas are doing. So above the, so this is the Gataiev coupling, and it's just a paramagnet. And then as you cool down, you can get some Z2 fluxes and itinerant Majoranas, and then at a very low temperature, really the only thing you expect is the itinerant Majoranas. A big step forward was made in this paper by George Ciccelli and Kalumin. George is, I believe, here at KITP. I've seen him walking around. Okay, there's George. So this really made the connection between real materials and this toy model that Gataiev came up with. And the proposed physical realization involves edge sharing octahedra on a honeycomb lattice involving these J effective 1/2 mod insulators. And they showed that in this configuration, the exchange would lead to a bond directional Kataev-like exchange. And I particularly like this figure for explaining sort of how everything works. So you've got, these bonds, so these are your metal ions, iridiums probably he was thinking about in this case. So this is going to be perpendicular to your x-axis. This is a triangular lattice. It's a little harder to visualize in the honeycomb, but in the triangular lattice, it's particularly easy to visualize how it works. And so here are your Ising couplings. And so we all know how to make J effective 1/2 mod insulators. This is our standard. This has been going on for quite a while since strontium-2, iridium-04. We learned how mod insulators can come from strong spin orbit coupling. And so the ions that were originally envisaged would be some of these 4D, 5D ions, like rhenium, ruthenium, osmium, rhodium, and iridium. And so in recent years, a lot of work has gone into understanding the Hamiltonian. So this is a generic Hamiltonian where you have a Heisenberg term, a Kataev term, and this gamma term, which is an off-diagonal exchange. And so what we expect in real materials is that other terms are, so that you want to find materials where this Kataev term is dominant and these other terms are small. And hopefully, if everything if this is really big and these are really small, the real materials will behave more or less as we expect from the theory. And a lot of work has been done on these Hamiltonians. When gamma is equal to zero, there's something called the Heisenberg-Kataev model, which can be solved numerically, and you can change parameters and get phase diagrams of different kinds of magnetic order. And this is just one. There's probably dozens by now of these kinds of studies. Okay, so the first material that we're sure was a Kataev material was this sodium-2 iridium-03, the very first Kataev material. And it was magnetic X-ray scattering that was shown to have the bond directional coupling. So this material is on a honeycomb lattice. It obeys all the requirements that George had laid out in his paper. Unfortunately, experiments showed that it wasn't as close as we would like to a real Kataev material. And so one idea was that if sodium could be replaced by lithium, a smaller ion, the geometry of the bonding would be a little better, and we might move closer to an ideal Kataev model. And so the next material people looked at was lithium-2 iridium-03. And in the process of studying this compound, a couple of other polytypes were discovered that had these kind of 3D Kataev-like lattices, hyper-honeycomb and stripy honeycomb. And I won't talk about those, but those are quite interesting as well. But this alpha lithium-2 iridium-03 is isostructural to the sodium compound. Unfortunately, it was hard to grow big crystals. Iridium, unfortunately, is not very neutron-friendly. It also orders at 15K, but has a very unusual magnetic structure. And eventually it was shown that this actually had stronger Kataev interactions than the sodium compound. And so the question, of course, is it possible to go smaller than lithium? And the answer is yes. You can put hydrogen in. And this is what Takagi's group did not too long ago. And he used a soft chemistry approach, ion exchange, to replace lithium with hydrogen. And by doing this, he was able to essentially replace the interlayer lithium ions with hydrogen ions, but keep this lithium iridium-2-06 honeycomb plane intact. And they did some NMR work and some other measurements, and this material does not order down to 50 millikelvin. And they were very careful in their paper They concluded that this compound was a quantum spin liquid, but they have not claimed that it's a cation quantum spin liquid, which is because they haven't had the evidence yet. So that's one of the lessons of my talk, is that even if you have all the ingredients, it takes a little bit of work to really claim that you have a cation spin, quantum spin liquid. And so in this material, you can be sure that there are cation interactions in the layers. There was no magnetic order. However, the heat capacity and the entropy doesn't agree with the cation model. And so this is a very lively topic of investigation about what's going on here, whether it is a cation quantum spin liquid or not. Unfortunately, because of the iridium, it's very difficult to do inelastic neutron experiments. Okay, but the idea of using ion exchange is actually, I think, very, very interesting. And we'd started a couple of years ago fooling around with some ion exchange, mainly because Simon Kimber was at Oak Ridge, and he did this work in 2010, and he was very interested in continuing some of this stuff. And so the basic idea is that you take a, in this case, Simon used, he wasn't thinking about cation materials. So like a delafosite, lithium-2, ruthenium-03, this is a simple structure, honeycomb lattice. And you put it in silver nitrate at a low temperature, only 200 degrees. And essentially what happens is the silver replaces most of the lithium, and you end up with silver-3, lithium-ruthenium-206. And it actually works pretty well, much better than I had expected. So we've fooled around a little bit. Nothing I've been really excited about yet. Nothing I want to show beyond this one little slide here. But we did look at some TEM on one of the samples, and unfortunately, I don't know why this is showing up here. It's not showing on my computer. But this is the same sample that Simon studied. And essentially, so we were doing this Z-contrast imaging, and actually it looks pretty good, a lot better than I was expecting, to be honest. We didn't see silver vacancies, and the ruthenium was also quite homogeneous. So I'm a little optimistic about using the soft chemical approaches to creating some interesting materials. Yes, George?
Quantum compound, as far as I know, dimerizes at very high temperatures.
Yes. Yes, as far as I know. I can double check Simon's paper. We just made this as practice, essentially, to see if we could. So I'm not very experienced yet with the soft chemistry, but we're working on it. So another recent material that has been produced using this approach is copper-2-iridium-03. As you can see, I had it on my list here. So you can start with sodium-2-iridium-03, and you can put it in copper chloride. And so in this case, you ended up with no sodium left in your sample. And so this material is attracting some interest. This work was done in Fazil Tafti's group. He again doesn't see any order down to low temperatures. However, he's recently reported on some USR, and some of the copper is apparently copper-2+, so there's definitely some disorder in this compound. And so, again, you have to be very careful about making any strong claims, but it's still something worth investigating. Maybe the samples can be improved. So one area we went into was the ruthenium instead of iridium, and our main motivation, to be perfectly honest, was to find cation materials we could do neutron scattering on. And so, you know, we sat down and we thought about some of the other ones. And this system has proved to be a lot of fun to work on. And again, it meets all the requirements that we expect. Honeycomb lattice, J effective equals 1/2 Mott insulator. It orders magnetically at 7 degrees, okay? So we know it doesn't have a quantum spin liquid ground state. Nevertheless, it's as I'll show you, it's quite interesting. So really what garnered, I think, the most attention with this material was the inelastic neutron scattering experiments and the theoretical modeling. So here's our data, and this is a theoretical model. And really, the agreement is quite compelling. And what I would like to emphasize is that you really need to do a lot of theoretical modeling to interpret your data in this area of science. And one thing I hadn't fully realized until I started was just how good the agreement between theory and experiment can be in neutron scattering. So this is a slide. This is some of Martin Morgel's work on a Heisenberg chain. And the agreement, the really quantitative agreement between the theory and experiment is amazing. And that's because neutrons are a very weakly interacting probe. And so all of the approximations you make are quite good for neutrons compared to photons, for example. Photons are much harder to model. Neutrons are, I think, relatively easy to model and compare with experiment. So the other thing about ruthenium trichloride, and I'll get back to this a little bit later, is that if you apply an in-plane field, you can suppress the magnetic ordering temperature down to zero with a field sort of in the 7.5 to 8.5 Tesla range, depending on the precise orientation that the field is applied in plane. So this is an in-plane field, and the scattering data in magnetic field is actually quite spectacular, where you can see the spectral intensity and the spin waves disappearing and going into the continuum scattering. And then at 8 Tesla or so, spin waves are all gone, and there's very intense continuum scattering. And it, really, from the scattering, it looks like we have a gapped spin liquid of some sort. And so this is a very interesting topic of ongoing investigation. What is the actual state here at 8 Tesla, a little higher, when the magnetic order is suppressed? And I'll come back to some of that at the very end, because I want to talk about some other materials. So right underneath ruthenium is osmium. And so there was some speculation that osmium trichloride might also be an interesting guttae of material. And there were some calculations done, and there were some old papers from like the 60s and 70s that claimed the existence of osmium trichloride. And so osmium is sort of a nasty one to work with. And so this work was done at Oak Ridge, and I didn't even do anything on it. But Michael McGuire took on the job of, so Michael is the one who came up with the chromium triiodide, if people remember Michael. But so he did a lot of work and concluded that the old reports of osmium trichloride were wrong, and really what people were looking at was this material here, osmium 0.55 chlorine 2. And this is a highly disordered material. There's both osmium 3+ and 4+ in the material. And so even though it's likely some of the interactions are guttae-like, I think the disorder kind of makes it a kind of a messy material to try to understand. And so I think that was a noble effort, but it didn't really go anywhere. So another suggestion was that maybe cobalt D7 would also form guttae of materials, right? This Kalulin and his collaborators suggested this. And in the paper, so cobalt D7 can sometimes form the pseudospin 1/2. There's a few examples of that. Most of the time it forms spin 3/2. But in the paper, he says that the study was partially motivated by these materials. And these materials have a honeycomb lattice that develop a zigzag type antiferromagnetic order at low temperatures. So One thing that caught my attention was this material. So this material is a honeycomb layered material. Now in this one, the cobalt is spin 3/2. It's got the same basic structure that we want for Katayev materials. Octahedra look almost perfect. However, the nail temperature is 122 Kelvin. But it also has a zigzag-like magnetic order. So, you know, for a while I was thinking, well, maybe one of the theorists can tell me later whether you can get a zigzag order out of a Heisenberg model in this, in a honeycomb. Yes, the answer is yes, okay. But there's also been some speculation that even in cobalt 3/2, you can get strong Katayev interactions. And so, but I'm not, I don't know whether, so it seems to me that in a lot of the cobalt materials, maybe the residual interactions are so strong, it might be hard to get a pure Katayev material. So another area that people have been looking are the rare earths. So this one has attracted some attention lately, ytterbium trichloride. So it's the same layered material, layered van der Waals material, with the ytterbiums on the metal sites. And so essentially they see some short range order at 1.2K and long range order at 0.6K, and they can apply an external magnetic field and suppress the magnetism. So this is also an area of, I think, quite interesting area with the rare earth, especially ytterbium 3+. We know that it can form spin 1/2. I'm not sure whether anybody's convincingly shown. Well, I think they're, yeah. So I think it's actually quite promising direction. Andy Christensen and collaborators have done some neutron scattering on ytterbium trichloride. And what Andy tells me at this point is that he doesn't see any evidence for Katayev magnetism. But again, the paper's not written. Maybe he'll change his mind. But at this point, we're not too excited that it's Katayev yet. Okay, so I'd like to talk about, for people who are following the ruthenium trichloride story, and not only that, but I'll talk about some recent developments. So one thing that we want to do, of course, is metallize our quantum spin liquid if we can. And one of our collaborators, Eric Hendrickson, who's at Washington University, he's a graphene guy. And so what Eric did was make a piece of graphene and put ruthenium trichloride on top of it and measure the transport properties of the graphene in proximity to ruthenium trichloride. And essentially, he's having a lot of trouble publishing his paper because the referees don't like his, they don't think his devices are good enough. But he did show that essentially that ruthenium trichloride has become charged doped. So he was able to show, even with his devices that aren't quite good enough, that there is charge transfer from the graphene to the ruthenium trichloride. And so this, in my view, is opening up some really new and exciting possibilities. So first of all, there's some theoretical attention being given. This is from Rosa Valenti's group. And everything is looking pretty good. She finds everything holds together. I won't talk about her abstract too much. But there is charge transfer. The ruthenium trichloride becomes metallized, and that could be a path forward. So one of the dreams, of course, is to, you know, put a quantum spin liquid and a normal metal in proximity and create a superconductor in the normal metal just from magnetic fluctuations. So this could be a path forward. Thank you. So, but what I'm really excited about, so we've spent a fair bit of effort trying to do some ionic liquid gating on ruthenium trichloride and other layered magnets, right? So one of the dreams, of course, is to be able to gate magnetism, right? And we haven't had much luck, to be honest. We tried a lot of different layered, van der Waals magnets, and the results have been uniformly miserable. But, you know, one of these sandwiches, right, with graphene and ruthenium trichloride, you could imagine that would be very, very gateable, right? And so, I'm sorry about that. I don't know why that it's not showing on my computer. Okay. So, what I'd like to point out, gating experiments on atomically thin magnets have mostly failed. Now, if you make a van der Waals heterostructure of graphene with a van der Waals magnet, I believe that's going to be working a lot better. I mean, graphene is super gateable, and you can imagine moving the chemical potential around with gating quite a bit. And I think with these sandwiches, we really have a chance of gating the magnetism and controlling the magnetism quite well. And so, if you agree with the first two, the third comment here would be that these materials that were worked on in the 80s are now going to be interesting in these graphite intercalated magnets. There's whole books written on these things. And so in this case, the Dresselhauses were have a chapter in here on magnetic intercalation compounds of graphite. And so there's a lot that you can imagine doing. You cleave your graphite, you make one of these graphite intercalation compounds, you cleave it thin, and you've got sort of magnetic layers built right in. So I think that's really going to be interesting. Okay, so another topic of great interest were these experiments coming out of Yuji Matsuda's group, where they find a quantized thermal hall connectivity. So I don't have much time. I won't go over these, but there's a couple of things I want to mention. So first of all, so this is not actually a phase diagram. This is a sort of an imagined phase diagram. It's not a measured one. These points here were just points where he didn't see any signal anymore. So I'll come back to that later. But we've been collaborating with Huan Ong's group, and they have yet to reproduce this on our samples. Okay, we have not been able to reproduce these measurements. Now, it does seem there's still some hope. It appears that the field, the direction they applied their field was not exactly the same, and so they're going to try it again, trying to reproduce the conditions of the earlier experiment. So the other thing we've done is to try to actually measure a phase diagram. We've used a bunch of different techniques, magnetocaloric effect, susceptibility, diffraction, inelastic neutron scattering, heat capacity. And so we did discover another zigzag phase. This is just a slightly different stacking sequence. And we did measure, and this is, I think, rather controversial, because not all groups agree. We did measure a thermodynamic phase boundary sort of on the other side, agreeing with this phase, this proposed phase diagram. So that's quite encouraging. The last thing I want to talk about is some work from Jason Alessia and Dave Austin. And Dave Austin is actually here at KITP. I haven't seen him here yet, but he's around somewhere. There he is, okay. And they have proposed ideas, and I want to thank Yoshi Maino, because it was at his meeting last year in Ariche that Jason and I had a chance to chat. And so that ended up actually motivating some of this theory, proposing an electrical probe of non-abelian spin liquids. And I think it was mostly based on David's, is this your PhD work? Okay. And I guess you're here now as a postdoc. And they proposed some concrete ideas for actually using ruthenium trichloride and some other, you know, superconductors, and they have, and these, okay, and these ideas are evolving, and I've run out of time. But Dave is here, and he gave a talk at the March meeting last time. And here are my conclusions, and I'm supposed to stop talking, but you can read the conclusions. Thank you.
Interesting talk. So.
This is probably a confused question. You had ruthenium, I think it was oxide, and an 8 tesla, you thought it might be a quantum spin liquid?
Ruthenium trichloride.
Trichloride, okay. I knew I was confused. So can you measure the specific heat and determine if it's a quantum spin liquid?
Yeah, I mean, people have measured this heat capacity.
In field? In it?
Well, yeah, I mean, people think it's a quantum spin liquid. They're not sure if it's a Gatayev quantum spin liquid. But yeah.
Okay. And how does the specific heat behave in field that makes it seem like a quantum spin liquid?
I'll have to dig up the data, okay. And we can discuss it. But I mean, I don't have that on top of my head exactly how it behaves. I mean, but it doesn't quite follow. So there's been a lot of numerical calculations of what the heat capacity should look like. And there's supposed to be a peak at very low temperatures at like K over 10 or something. And as far as I know, that peak has not been observed. But there's bumps sort of at higher temperatures that seem to follow the theory pretty well. So.
I have a question about the plot of the attempt to reproduce the thermal conductance data in ruthenium chloride.
Yes.
Could you show the plot? Because I have some questions about what's exactly depicted there. So one question is, now I see what's the meaning of different colors. But could you explain, you mentioned that the magnetic field was directed in a different way. So could you comment in more details, what's exactly the difference between the two experiments?
Yeah, so, okay. So first of all, you need to tilt the sample, right? So you get both an in-plane and an out-of-plane component to the magnetism. And then you need to orient your sample. So this critical field where the magnetism is suppressed varies a little bit as you rotate the sample in the field. And so the minimum field is, I think, in the 110 direction, and I don't think they had that nailed down quite. I don't remember exactly they were close, but not quite in their orientation of their crystal in the field.
And the geometry of the sample is the same, or maybe there are also some differences?
No, the geometry, so the problems with this experiment really have to do with the fact that these crystals are really fragile, and it doesn't take much to damage them. And so you have to be super careful when you're like mounting the thermometers and everything, because just a little bit of mechanical damage essentially ruins everything. And so there's some... So according to Juan, there's some tricks that they're not telling him. So, and I guess the lead author, Kasahara, actually spent a year working at Princeton, and so Juan is hoping he'll eventually reveal his tricks for mounting the sample. So this is all I know, to be honest. I mean, it's tricky, it's a very hard experiment. Matsuda did tell me that. So what I didn't have time to explain was that when the crystals are damaged mechanically, you end up getting a 14K transition rather than the 7K, and some crystals even have mixtures of both, and that's just from stacking faults from mechanical damage. But crystals that show the 14K transition do not show this quantized thermal Hall effect. So any kind of damage will spoil the experiment. So I think... Jury is still out. I mean, Juan is very hopeful. So.
Okay. maybe I have the next question, or yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. You go first.
Okay, sure. I couldn't see, so I wasn't sure. Okay, so if you go to the next slides, we're following on that first question where you said you see the thermodynamic phase diagram that's not next to the zigzag two-phase, so can you say more about that?
Oh, about this region here?
No, the one on the right, from a Tesla going up to higher magnetic
this,
fields.
Where it says, yeah. Right, okay, above?
Yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, so the nature of that, so we're trying to probe, you know, what is the nature of this phase, right? You suppress the magnetism, and this is the exact same region that the quantized thermal Hall effect was observed, right?
And not asking about the region itself, but the boundary. You have the circles and the cross.
Yeah, what do you see exactly? These circles are magnetocaloric effect measurements done by Yasu Takano, who's at the Magnet Lab at University of Florida. And he's an expert on this technique. And it's a very sensitive way of detecting thermodynamic anomalies. And he measures anomalies at these circles here as we ramp up the magnetic field. And the other piece of evidence that we have is that this cross here basically means you could see spin waves again. So essentially you have spin waves all the way up to here, or wherever we had spin waves in here too. And then the spin waves disappear in this region, and then you see spin waves again that come back up on the other side. So the spin waves disappear and then reappear.
And at what frequency scales?
We're talking like half a millivolt or something. I mean, small energy scales. I can tell you, I have to dig it up in the paper, but it's something like that. It's small.
Thanks.
And there's a lot of, the question of whether there's a gap here is also, I think, somewhat controversial. We believe there's a gap. We see a gap in neutron scattering. But there are other reports out there that say there is no gap. But there has to be a gap if this thermal the quantized thermal Hall effect is there. So that's true.
Can you go back to I just want to know a little bit more about the intercalated graphite stuff. I don't think I quite understood what this is. So.
Okay.
Is this like every other layer is?
Yeah, well, okay, that's what the staging tells you.
Okay.
Right? So every other layer would be stage one. It's like every second layer, stage two.
And how do you make these?
How do you make them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you essentially put these chlorides, and there's some other ones too. Put them into a furnace with some graphite. You heat it up, and it just wants to go in. But, yeah, no, I'm pretty excited about this, actually, because I think, I think these are going to grow in importance. That's my prediction. just because you can gate magnetism with these.
So my question was actually overlapping with a question Itamar already asked. So coming back to this boundary of the phase diagram in the field.
Yes.
How much would be the magnetization roughly about 8 Tesla compared to the maximum value you can reach?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Why don't we look at, I'll have to look at the paper. We can look at it together, right? We have all that data. Okay. I just don't have that. I wish I had a perfect memory, but I don't.
Because in principle, these are no phase transition, right? So you mentioned the anomaly in thermodynamics, but those circles, it's not a phase transition.
It's not a phase transition.
Well, I believe, there's no symmetric breaking across the...
Oh, yeah, sure, but it's believed to be a topological phase transition. Yes.
So I guess in your mind, what's sort of the long term? I mean, how do you really characterize what the structure is doing after? I mean, in terms of local disorder, once you suck ions out and you put a bunch back in, right? It kind of makes the average structure maybe look nice, but the local structure might be very hard to interrogate. Right?
Yeah, no, this is a worry I have with because more and more people are using soft chemistry approaches to create quantum materials, right? This recent announcement of, you know, the nickelate that's superconducting, that's made with a soft chemistry approach. Even these, you know, these thallophosites that Andy McKenzie is studying, like palladium, cobalt, O2, those are all made with soft chemistry. So yeah, these are good questions, and probably some sort of local probe. I mean, TEM is very good for some of this, but maybe some kind of PDF or something would be helpful too.
I mean, maybe. Are diffusion limits sort of like at the end of the day an inherent limit on how big your sample could eventually be?
Well, this is a good question because, you know, years ago, do you remember the sodium cobalt O2 where you could put water in it and make it a superconductor? We actually were able to grow a pretty big crystal of that if you're patient. So I think if you're patient, you can actually get some reasonably big crystals, you know, by intercalation and that sort of thing. And maybe this ion exchange is not going to be as good for getting big crystals. We may have to come up with some other approach. But yeah, those are all valid questions, and I think will become increasingly important as more and more quantum materials are made this way.
Okay, so time's up, so let's thank Sophie again.